You're listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2013 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please visit www.lfla.org/aloud. The critic James Wood has praised Alexander Heman for both being both a relentless demystifier and a playful mythologist. And I thought that was quite an astute insight into Heman's sly tactics and stunning talent as a writer. So if I were trying to sum up why I love Alexander, a.k.a. Sasha's work, I'd read you reason number 7 from his essay disguised as a list, Reasons Why I Do Not Wish to Leave Chicago, an Incomplete Random List. Reason number 7, he writes, looking directly west at night from any Edgewater or Rogers Park high-rise, airplanes hover and glimmer above O'Hare. Once my mother and I spent an entire evening sitting in the dark, listening to Frank Sinatra, watching the planes which resembled stunned fireflies, transfixed with the continuous wonder of what this world is. Alexander Heman is transfixed with the continuous wonder of what this world is, which includes stunned fireflies, as well as the insane wars of nationalism, the beauties of beekeeping, as well as deep sadness of loss, the pleasures of a neighborhood hangout, and an accordionist who may or may not have been his great-grandfather and who may or may not have been present at the moment the Archduke is assassinated in Sarajevo. Heman is the author of The Lazarus Project, which was a finalist for the 2008 National Book Award and the National Book Critics Circle Award, and the author of 3 books of short stories, The Question of Bruno, Nowhere Man, which was also a finalist for the National Book Critics Award, and Love and Obstacles. He's a recipient of the 2003 Guggenheim Fellowship and a grant from the MacArthur Foundation. He was born in Sarajevo, and he visited Chicago on a visiting residency in 1992, intending to stay for a matter of months when, as you know, the siege of Sarajevo began and he was unable to return home. He lives in Chicago today with his wife and daughter. So tonight you'll hear him read in his own voice and words as he turns memory and history inside out and upside down, and he'll read from his wonderful new book of essays, The Book of My Lives. Please welcome Alexander Heman. Thank you.
Thank you, Louise. Thank you all for coming. It's a great pleasure to be here. It's a beautiful room, beautiful library. Libraries are temples of books and knowledge, and so let's worship some. I will read from the Book of My Lives, the essay that is called, or the story rather, that is called The Book of My Life. Professor Nikola Koljevic had the long, slender fingers of a piano player. Although he was now a literature professor, he was my teacher at the University of Sarajevo in the late 80s. As a student, he'd supported himself by playing the piano in the jazz bars of Belgrade. He'd even had gigs as a member of a circus orchestra. He'd sit at the fringe of the arena, I imagined, with a Shakespeare tragedy open above the piano keys, flexing his fingers, ignoring the lions, waiting for the clowns to enter. Professor Koljevic taught a course in poetry and criticism, for which we read poetry with a critical slant. The new critic, Clint Brooks, was his patron saint. In his class, we learned how to analyze the inherent properties of a piece of literature, disregarding politics, biography, or anything external to the text. Most of the other teachers delivered their lectures passionlessly, even haughtily. Possessed by the demons of scholastic boredom, they asked for nothing in particular from us. In Professor Koljevic's class, on the other hand, we unpacked poems like Christmas presents, and the solidarity of common discoveries filled a small hot room on the top floor of the Faculty of Philosophy. He was incredibly well-read. He often quoted Shakespeare in English off the top of his head, which always impressed me. I, too, wanted to have read everything and to be able to quote with ease. He also taught an essay writing course, the only writing course I've ever taken, where we read the classic essays beginning with Montaigne and then tried to produce some lofty-seeming thoughts, coming up with hapless imitations instead. Still, it was flattering that he found it even remotely possible we could write something belonging to the same universe as Montaigne. It made us feel as if we had been personally invited to participate in the fine, gentle business of literature. Once, Professor Kordevich told us about the book his daughter had begun to write at the age of 5. She had titled it The Book of My Life, but had written only the first chapter. She planned to wait for more life to accumulate, he told us, before starting chapter 2. We laughed, still in our early chapters, oblivious to the malignant plots accelerating all around us. After I'd graduated, I phoned to thank Professor Kordevich for what he taught me, for introducing me to the world that could be conquered by reading. Back then, calling him was a brave act for a student, ever in awe of his professors, but he was not put out. He invited me for an evening stroll by the Miljatska River, and we discussed literature and life as friends and equals. He put his hand on my shoulder as we walked, his fingers cramped like hooks as he held on, for I was considerably taller than he. It was uncomfortable, but I said nothing. He had flatteringly crossed the border, and I did not want to undo the closeness. Not long after our stroll, I began working as an editor for Naše Dani, a magazine in Sarajevo. At around the same time, Professor Kordevich became one of the highest positioned members of the Serbian Democratic Party, a virulently nationalist organization headed by Radovan Karadžić, now in The Hague, on a war crimes trial, the talentless poet destined to become the world's most wanted war criminal. I attended SDS press conferences and listened to Karadžić's roaring paranoia and racism, his imposing head looming on our horizon, large cuboid topped with an unruly gray mane. And Professor Kordevich would be there too, sitting next to Karadžić, small, solemn, and academic, with large jar-bottom glasses, wearing a tweed jacket with suede elbow patches, his long fingers crossed loosely in front of his face, as if suspended between a prayer and applause. Afterward, I'd come up to greet him dutifully, assuming that we still shared a love of books. Stay out of this, he'd advise me. Stick to literature. In 1992, when the Serbian attack on Bosnia and the siege of Sarajevo began, I found myself in the United States. Safe in Chicago, I watched Serbian snipers shoot at the knees and ankles of a man trying to escape from a truck that had been hit by a rocket. On the front pages of magazines and newspapers, I saw emaciated prisoners in Serbian camps and the terrified faces of people running down Sniper Alley. I watched as the Sarajevo Library perished in patient, deliberate flames. The infernal irony of a poet, bad though he may have been, and a literature professor, causing the destruction of hundreds of thousands of books, did not escape me. On the news, I sometimes caught a glimpse of Professor Kordevich standing beside Karadžić, who was always denying something. What was happening was for him either self-defense or it was not happening at all. Occasionally, Professor Kordevich talked to reporters himself, mocking the questions about rape camps or deflecting all accusations of Serbian crimes by framing them as the unfortunate things that take place in every civil war. In Marcel Ofelis's film, The Troubles We've Seen, a documentary about foreign reporters covering the war in Bosnia, Professor Kordevich, labeled as Serbian Shakespearean, speaks to a BBC reporter, dispensing spin phrases in impeccable English and explaining away the sounds of Serbian shells falling on Sarajevo in the background as a part of the ritual celebration of Orthodox Christmas. Obviously, he said, from the old times, Serbs like to do this. He smiled as he said that, apparently relishing his own cleverness. But it's not even Christmas, the BBC reporter observed. I became obsessed with Professor Kordevich. I kept trying to identify the first moment when I could have noticed his genocidal proclivities. Racked with guilt, I recall lectures and the conversations we had, as if picking through ashes, the ashes of my library. I unread books and poems I used to like, from Emily Dickinson to Danilo Kish, from Frost to Tolstoy, unlearning the way in which he had taught me to read them because I should have known, I should have paid attention. I had been mired in close reading, impressionable and unaware that my favorite teacher was involved in plotting a vast crime. But what's done cannot be undone. Now it seems to me clear, now it seems clear to me that his evil had far more influence on me than his literary vision. I excised and exterminated that precious youthful part of me that had believed you could retreat from history and hide from evil in the comforts of art. Because of Professor Kordovich, perhaps, my writing is infused with testy impatience for bourgeois babbling, regrettably tainted with helpless rage I cannot be rid of. Toward the end of the war, Professor Kordovich fell out of favor with Karadzic and was demoted from the realms of power. He spent his time drinking heavily, now and then giving an interview to a foreign journalist, ranting about various injustices committed against the Serbian people in general and himself in particular. In 1997, he blew his Shakespearean brains out. He had to shoot twice, his long piano player finger apparently having trembled on the unwieldy trigger. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Sasha. That's really a stunning, stunning story. And welcome to Los Angeles. I'm sorry that you spent 2 hours in traffic getting here.
I spent the afternoon between Santa Monica and downtown LA.
You might have to pull this mic a little bit closer to you. Is that? Can you hear us fine? Okay, good. I was watching a documentary the other night about Philip Roth, and there was a wonderful quote from Nicole Krauss, whom you probably know, and she was talking about, she had this phrase, we go to art to look for people, to look at people struggling with moral failing. And I was thinking about that in terms of that story. I mean, I don't even know that the professor was struggling in that sense.
There's no indication that he was struggling.
No.
He was beyond access, as it were, after he joined the war, or the war, people who were waging the war.
Did you carry that story around with you a long time? Did you try it in different forms, or did it come out in this essay? Was that your first go at it?
Well, it was. I wrote it for The New Yorker, and it was, I think, one of the fiction issues, and they had the theme influences, so various writers wrote about influences. other writers or people who influenced them. So I wrote that as an influence piece.
Yeah, the very idea of unlearning what he taught you is such an intriguing idea. How did you go about it?
Well, I reread a lot of things and then read many new things or things that I hadn't read with that fact in the equation, as it were, mm-hmm. with that factor in the equation that, you could read Shakespeare and quote Shakespeare and still be a fascist. Because we are so, I'm still have a hard time letting go of the idea that art and reading and books are ennobling, right? We have libraries, we celebrate books, we are here because we like books, and we are, I'm prejudicial in the sense that I think the people who are here for books, they're probably good people. I hope there are no war criminals here. All war criminals, raise your hands. I had to question the very project of literature in the light of war embargoes, in the light of the fact that my literature professor, not only literature professor, but my favorite one, was a fascist. I had another professor who I hated from the first day I laid my eyes on him, and he is said to have been photographed kicking a human head like a soccer ball. But I did not, his crimes did not surprise me. I knew he was a moral nobody, well before the war. But this professor, he opened up literature, the door of literature to me, and said, come in. And so I went in, and then, he was doing something out in the back.
No,
all
that's
the way.
That's quite a betrayal. I was thinking also when, and you referred to this in that same essay, I believe, about how poetry was used as a foundational text in Serbian nationalism. Could you talk about that a little bit, the mountain wreath and what that represented?
Well, it's, you know, we still cling to the notion, and you can see it in the movies everywhere, that, you know, leaders have to make tough decisions. And if they have to make a tough decision to go to war, it's really the hardest for them. So in the Mountain Wreath, it's about, it's set in Montenegro in, I think, 17th century, the leader of the Montenegrin tribes, and Montenegrins, still half of Montenegrins consider themselves to be Serbs. He has to decide whether to exterminate the Muslim Montenegrins because they are the fifth column of the Turks and they're surrounded by the Ottoman Empire. And so he has to go through this process of making a decision whether to exterminate them. And this is all rendered in decasyllabic meter, which is a classic Serbian epic meter. There are many beautiful poems and epic poems in that meter. And so after a while, you know, he talks to his warriors, he meets a delegation of local Muslims, and he implores them to return to the faith of their forefathers. And then he has to make a tough decision. And there's this famous monologue when he says, "Let there be what cannot be. Neka bude šta biti ne može." And he decides to take them out. Now, you know, I would not blame a book for genocidal projects 3 centuries later. But the book was considered as a foundational text of Serbian nationalists, as was this epic cycle. I mean, decasyllabic poetry is the foundational text of Serbian culture for nationalists. And so this was the pattern for Karadzic, I think. The other thing that I mentioned in the essay, I remember at the moment or the day when he addressed Bosnian Parliament, and he was not an elected official, never. He was never elected to any position. Where he told the parliament to not go down the highway of hell and suffering by voting for Bosnian independence, threatening with genocide, in other words. And I wondered afterwards, at that time I didn't understand what the importance of that was. And he also used the word annihilation. Or he said the Muslim people might disappear. And I thought he was speaking metaphorically, but he was actually, you know, considering that. And only in retrospect, I thought about it, and I wonder why did he address them at all? They could not be talked out of it. War was well on its way, the whole project. Why would he have done that? My opinion is that it was a kind of a public performance, right? It was a recruitment thing, as it were. And he was projecting this image of a leader who has to make a tough decision, saying, "If you make me do it, I'll do it," right? And he tried to do it. Now he's in The Hague.
You made a note about how, we often talk about what's lost in translation, in translating from one literature to another. I think you've made a note, I can't remember where you said it, but, you know, in thinking about how translation, what's gained in translation, and there was a comment that you made that I thought was really interesting. It was about how it kind of, translation is kind of a counterforce to national, you know, in a literature. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Well, when I was growing up, there were two competing ideologies that one could be exposed to. It was, on the one hand, it was communism and socialism, where the working class was the engine, the category, the community, or the category that was, you know, the engine of history or coming history. And then the other collective was the nation. And so, and in Yugoslavia, in strange ways of my youth, those two ideologies in some ways existed simultaneously, and that they could collaborate. But I was young and I was individualist, and to me both of those were repulsive, so that my aesthetics, as it were, was developed in opposition to all that. And this is why I ended up, you know, with my professor in some ways, because I thought, oh, it's just close reading, you stay away from that stuff. But anyway, I know a lot about nationalism. And one of the axiomatic propositions of nationalism is that you can only fully express yourself as a person or as a citizen within the national culture or the nation state, right? This is why this is the foundation for all the wars in former Yugoslavia. The Serbs and the Croats, first the Croats and the Slovenians and the Serbs, they wanted a nation state where they would all be together. There would be no mixed people, there would be no federations, there would be none of that. This is the reason for ethnic cleansing. On a cultural level, that means that we need our language, we need our literature, because outside of that, no one can understand what we're talking about, because literature and culture express our national essence, which is suppressed in a situation in which we don't have a nation state, or we are, you know, subject to some other empires, or we live with others who constantly taint our national essence. So that writer's duty is to find ways to represent this national essence. And this is what they really do. They don't tell stories. If they do, they tell the stories about this national essence, which is why it is common in Europe, and not just Eastern Europe, but Western Europe, that, you know, writers, novelists, they're elected to national academies of arts and sciences, and they are the elite, and at which point they can stop writing novels, and at which point, even if they write them, they're beyond judgment. And so the program, as it were, for the Serbian, the Greater Serbia Project, which was the project of Serbian nationalists, was written by the members of the Serbian National Academy of Arts and Sciences. But it's all based on this concept of, you know, national essence and national language and national culture, national literature, and all this. Everything has this, you know, qualification of national, or rather attribute of national. Now, if this is the case, then translation cannot possibly work, because you can only understand a national literature if you're a member of that nation. And even that, if you don't understand, it means that your essence is tainted by exposure to others. So that in national nationalist literary discourse, the purest, the people who contain the purest essence are in the countryside, and they're usually, you know, they can't read. Because they just spontaneously pour out their essence. And this is, you know, and they sing in the Balkan terms, they, you know, they perform these decasyllabic poems. They didn't, they have not read, you know, Philip Roth. They would spoil the essence. And so the project of translation then is contrary to that concept of literature.
I love
and
that.
It's also the notion or the claim that poetry or culture or literature cannot really be translated goes along with that, you know, nationalist concept. And in opposition to all that, and also to the practice of what I do, what I have done, is that translation is essential to literature, is essential to the very existence of any culture, including nationalist culture, mind you. And it is something, in the end, that we do every day within the language, even if it's the only language there's only one language we use and speak and read. Within this language, there's a continuous situation of translation.
And the Sarajevo that you grew up in was multicultural to some extent, right? I mean, there was a mixture of Ukrainians, Bosnians.
Very few Ukrainians.
Just your family.
Right.
You brought borscht with you.
Right.
Brought your family recipe.
Well, it was multicultural, but see, I did not see myself as belonging to this culture and my best friend, who may have had a different ethnic background, as belonging to other culture. When they talk about multicultural, there are these traditions, you know, that could be easily and lazily identified with religions, but it's more complicated than that. So that you have churches and synagogues and mosques, you know, within 100 yards of one another. But there's a horizontal, as it were, layering of cultures. That is, I grew up in the city, and I do not understand the countryside. And to a large extent, regrettably, people of my generation, we went to rock and roll, and, you know, we listened to foreign music and movies and read, you know, foreign literature. We thought of ourselves as entirely different and distinct from people who had a rural background in some ways, who did not grow up in the city. And there it was a kind of bigotry, I understand now. But still, to us, that was my culture.
You said that you or you wrote about growing up, you know, talked about listening to Talking Heads and Patti Smith and learning a lot of the English that you learned was it American combat films or World War II combat films?
Well, all kinds of films. There was no censorship. And so you could go and see if, you know, a movie. When I was five, we would hang out in front of a movie theater and ask strangers to take us in as their children for free. And this, you know, there were kung fu movies abounded, and spaghetti westerns before they became cool, and all kinds of movies.
Well, I loved you had a transliteration in one story, I think in Love and Obstacles, about where the English that you learned was an imitation of soldiers with gum in their mouths.
Right.
Could you say a little English in that, a little American in that form?
My dad claimed that to speak American English, you have to speak with a chewing gum in your mouth. And to speak British English, you have to have hot tea in your mouth.
The range of emotions that your work evokes is really quite astonishing. I was telling Sasha that, you know, there aren't that many. I mean, I would be screaming with laughter and have to wake up my husband. I must read this to you. I must read this to you. You talk, your essays are such a beautiful way to bridge your life before and after 1992, this kind of weaving together of the different kind of sides of your life, in a sense. One of the phrases when you talked about living in Sarajevo that I thought was interesting, you talked about there's no word for privacy in Bosnian. Could you talk about what does that mean to you? What is that like?
Well, everyone knows you. And people know things about you, and the way the human relations work, you would know about other people even before you met them or spoke to them. Well, the dating operations worked entirely differently. You could exchange glances with someone for years, and you would know anything about them: what school they went to, what, you know, who they were hanging out with. You might know things about their parents because your parents would know their parents.
Yeah.
And so, at some point after you may have, you know, gone through other relationships or whatever, you would just approach, and it was all ready. You could start right away. There was no reason to learn anything about anyone else. It was also that I lived with my parents until I was 27. One of the downsides of socialism was that there was no housing, so you couldn't leave. And so, you know, my mother would go through my stuff and read my poetry and then get worried about my mental state. And rightly
with
so,
good,
I should
good
point
reason,
out.
I think.
Yes, and, you know, to this day, I'm answering email at the computer and suddenly my father's here reading my email. He says, "Who is that? Who are you talking to?" Because the notion of private space around you, we all operate within a bubble of, you know, about a yard around our bodies is sacred ground. You do not step into it without, it's trespassing, without, you know, permission. And I was once, I returned to Sarajevo. In fact, I went to Belgrade, it doesn't matter, but I was waiting in line for a bus, and it was a yard between me and the person ahead of me because I acquired American habits, and five people walked in. Before I understood that, you know, our pelvises need to rub too. It doesn't work that way. It's because, I don't know, I don't have a sociological answer to that, but you simply were connected with other people at all times. When I was young, I actually suffered for the lack of privacy like that. But at the same time, when I found myself in Chicago, I was perfectly alone. No one knew me. No one to hang out with, no one to rub pelvises with. I realized how much I depended on that, how I was really a cluster of others, how so many people intersected in me, and suddenly all that network that I had not even been aware of was missing entirely.
Well, it's so clear in these essays when you write about Sarajevo that it's such an embodied, your relationship was so embodied. I mean, when you go back and you talk about how you turned involuntarily because your body remembered, that's that's where you used to look at the movie marquee, you know, even though it was no longer a movie theater. And so you had to really establish as a flaneur, as a wanderer in the city, your own embodied relationship with Chicago. And that has happened, right? I mean, it's taken you many years, but you started going door to door, literally, to get to know the city.
Yes, I was working for Greenpeace for 2.5 years, and I went around.
They actually paid you?
Yeah, well, I was not very well. Early on, it was commission, and I couldn't convince anyone to give me any money. So it was very low commission, but then they had to comply with minimum wage law. So there was minimum wage. That saved me, because I lived on minimum wage most of the time, and occasionally I would go above the quota. So you would be paid minimum wage unless you went over the quota, and then to the minimum wage, a commission would be added. So occasionally I would have some commission, but not frequently. But one of the things I realized is how much I depended, and my sense of myself, including the body, particularly the body, depended on the way one relates to space. Mm-hmm. I was stuck in traffic between Santa Monica and L.A. I have no concept of L.A. I do not know where I am in L.A.
That was L.A.
I know, but I still geographically I cannot place myself where things are, because I have never walked
right
in L.A. You know, and I can picture the map of New York, or at least Manhattan, in my head when I walk around.
Come back and walk with us. There's some great walks here. There really are.
Next time.
Okay. Okay.
Next time I'm walking to Santa Monica.
Well, actually, the writer Will Self did walk here from LAX. Yes,
I know. If not, but he walks from every airport.
He walks from every airport. You know, there's such, as I said, such a range of emotion in this book, and humor is so important to some of these stories. And I wondered, I have this wonderful book that I love called Hammer and Tickle, which is about the importance of jokes in communist countries, and I was thinking of that Orwell quote that every joke is a tiny revolution, because so many of the escapades you and your friends kind of engaged in as youth seem like they were these jokes, these Dadaist jokes that were your own form of revolution. Did you see them that way?
Well, there were so many jokes, and people are constantly generating jokes. You can go on websites that are entirely devoted to jokes from Bosnia or former Yugoslavia.
There's a whole website of Bosnian jokes?
No, there's a number of them. It's easy. And to find, and there's a particular genre of siege jokes that are, many of them are funny, but some of them are just, are you kidding me? They're very intense. A typical joke is, the star characters in Bosnian jokes are Sulja and Muja, right? So what do Sulja and Muja do on a seesaw, right? They are teasing the sniper. It's that kind of a joke. And they constantly, you would get jokes from my friends under the siege. They would say, "Did you hear this one?" And it's not just, constantly, in any situation, jokes come up. It's one of the, whenever you have a critical mass of Bosnia, at some point, jokes start to be exchanged. But it's not only that. These are, jokes are a genre. They have a format and they have stock characters. But the conversion of experience into something that could be funny is, it's bigger than just jokes. That's jokes are a subset of that process, as it were. I was when I went back to Sarajevo for the first time after the war, it was 97, and then I saw people who I hadn't seen since before the war, and they lost some members of their family, and by and large they were telling me stories about the siege as funny stories. That is, how do you wash yourself with a 2-liter bottle of Coke and then use that water to flush the toilet? And they would, these older skinny people, still, skinny after the siege, they would show me how it would, very difficult. It was very funny. I remember, this is a story I often tell, my grandmother, a woman who I consider as my grandmother, she and her son and his family his sons, her grandson, they all lived together, about 10 people in the apartment. And so there was no food, and they were in a tough part of the city, close to the river, which was the front line. And so there was no food, and every once in a while, one of them would go out to forage for food, find something. And once one of them, I think her son, came back with a single shriveled potato. They hadn't seen the potato in so God knows how long. And what do you do with one potato and 10 people? But they hadn't seen the potato. So they put the potato in the middle of the table and they sat around the table and they watched the potato. There was no television there. They watched the potato. And they told me this was roaring with laughter. It was a knee slapper watching the potato. But of course, when you just stop laughing, you realize how horrible that is.
Really horrible.
And so this is not comic relief. It's far beyond comic relief. Mm. I've thought about this for years. To my mind, to tell a funny story after all that is to regain some agency. I am going to choose how this is going to be interpreted, right? And also, in a very basic way, celebrating the fact that, well, we have survived. So there's a survival aspect to it, but also a way to regain agency in an act of narration. And this is still the case. People still talk, not about the war, but it's very tough in Bosnia right now. The stories are still the funniest stories you could possibly hear.
Your parents often appear in some of the stories that are funny, some not. For instance, the performance that you did, that is, I assume it really did happen, where you dressed as a Ukrainian collaborator.
Yes.
That one did not evoke a lot of laughter for your parents. They were rather...
No. I drank vodka out of a cup because it's in, compliance with the concept of a Ukrainian collaborator. And then passed out early.
But your parents, your family make wonderful characters in both your fiction and your nonfiction. Czesław Miłosz wrote, "Any family with a writer born into it is ruined." And I think you make good work of that quote. But my very favorite tale about your parents, which you now have said is fiction, right, from Love and Obstacles, I was going to ask you to read a section, and we could set it up a little bit. There's a Pulitzer Prize-winning author that the young writer, Bosnian writer, has invited to his parents' house after a night of drunken
carousing. Right, a Pulitzer Prize-winning author named McAllister visits Sarajevo, and a young Bosnian author gets drunk with him. McAllister doesn't drink. He's a former alcoholic, and also he's a vegetarian.
And a Buddhist.
So in his drunken excitement, the narrator invites McAllister to come to his house for lunch with his parents. And once he sobers up, he realizes McAllister would never come. But then McAllister comes, surprising them. So now he's at lunch with the narrator and his parents. McAllister liked the coffee. He loved the banana cake. He washed down each forkful with a sip from his demitasse. He actually grunted with pleasure. "I am so full, I will never eat again," he said. "You're an excellent cook, ma'am. Thank you very much." "It is good food, natural, no American food, no cheeseburger," mother said. "I will ask you a question," father said. "You must tell truth." "Don't answer," I said. "You don't have to answer." McAllister must have thought I was joking, for he said, "Shoot." "My son is a writer, you are a writer, you are good, you win Pulitzer." I knew exactly what was coming. "Tell me, is he good? Be objective," father said. "Nemoj, tata," I begged, but he was unrelenting. Mother was looking at McAllister with expectation. I poured myself another drink. "Takes a while to become a good writer," McAllister said. "I think he's well on his way." "He always likes to read," mother said. "Everything else lazy," father said, "but always read books. When he was a young man, he always wrote poesy. Sometimes I find poems and I cry," mother said. "I'm sure he was talented," McAllister said. "Perhaps," McAllister had in fact read something I wrote. "Perhaps it was that I was drunk, for I was holding back tears." "Do you have children?" mother asked him. "No," McAllister said. "Actually, yes, he lives with his mother in Hawaii. I'm not a good father." "It is not easy," my father said. "Always worry." "No," McAllister said. "I would never say it's easy." Mother reached across the table for my hand, tugged it to her lips, and kissed it warmly. At which point I stood up and left the room.
And we should add that the parents also served him plenty of meat and right. poured him several glasses of the wonderful border, the permeable borderland between fiction and nonfiction in your work is quite a marvel. And if one reads a fiction book around the same time you're reading the nonfiction book, it gives a really interesting sense of, because similar stories appear in both fiction and nonfiction, only with details that may or may not have happened. I wondered if you have a sense of that permeability, partly because of growing up under communism when, as a friend of mine said, under communism you always knew what was going to happen tomorrow because it was as the same as what happened today, but you never knew what was going to happen in the past because it kept changing. Would you say that that contributes to your sense of that permeability?
Well, yes, because but there is something to that. Although Yugoslav communism was not so fantastic as, say, Albanian or Romanian or even Soviet, there was some contact with reality. But any ideological society does that. You know, we have reality TV. That's a contradiction in terms, by definition. Not to mention the Iraq War, where there was this great Potemkin village of the weapons of mass destruction. And perhaps because I grew up in communism, not for a moment did I think that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction. Not because I knew something about Iraq, but because of the manner in which they were building that story. Mm. It was clear. There was a tell. Oliver Sacks has an essay in one of his books about aphasiacs, people who have trouble comprehending language, watching a Ronald Reagan speech on television and roaring with laughter because they could not understand what he was saying. They knew he was lying. They could read his face. And so in a similar way, I could read that they were lying from day one. But there's another thing, and I don't think it's related to ideological experiences. Just as there's no word for privacy in Bosnian and Serbian and Croatian, the related languages, there are no words that are equivalent to fiction and nonfiction.
Mm. I didn't know
that.
This
is not related to truth and, you know, lies, but rather in terms of literary forms and genres and modes, there is no nonfiction. My translator, who's very good in Sarajevo, is translating this book right now, and she cannot find a word for nonfiction, and I cannot help her. The closest that I can come to nonfiction is true stories. But of course, it throws it in a different direction because then stories or storytelling becomes the umbrella term for both fiction and nonfiction. And because I have thought about all that when I was preparing this book, I write nonfiction. The same thing that drives me to write fiction drives me to write nonfiction. These are the stories that I want to tell.
Mm-hmm.
And they just have different limitations, different responsibilities toward the reader, different promises to the reader. This is true, I promise. And also responsibilities toward the people who are in those true stories, who have shared them, because they're not mine. So I have to respect their experience and not diminish it or enlarge it for effect.
So the story about the professor, you would not choose to write in as fiction. I mean, you want to have that responsibility to the reader that this truly happened.
Well, one aspect of what we call nonfiction or true stories is bearing witness.
Mm-hmm.
And so many of the private stories, as it were, that, you know, things that happened to me, I feel free to embellish and you know, because I'm pretty much the only one who really remembers that thing happened. So I can add on things and, you know, embellish heavily and turn it into fiction. So a lot of true stories that I tell people at dinner parties or just randomly babbling, I hold on to them until they mature into fiction. But there are a few of those pieces in the book that I just, there's a bearing witness aspect to it, but it's also that they're too big, as it were. Not too big, too unwieldy to be converted into fiction without losing something.
That's a really helpful way to look at it. I'm really glad you explained that. What would you say is the importance of the reader to these stories? I mean, where do we come in? Do you write for a particular reader? Do you either in the either kind of story that you're writing?
Well, I don't write for a particular reader. I write for readers. I write for myself as I remember myself when I was young and enjoyed reading books. I write for myself before my professor became a fascist in some ways, which is a problem in some ways. But it's also that I think literature as a human project, but also as my project, in my particular project, what I write, it, to me, it's a continuous conversation. I've started it with the first book, and then with each book starts a new conversation. This is a conversation. This is why I do these things. This is not a sales job for me. This is a responsibility to the conversation that I started by writing this book. There are some ideas, there are some experiences, there are, you know, someone responded to this. You responded to this. You came so that we could talk about this. And this continuous conversation, you know, there are many rounds of it, as it were. People ask me, am I bothered if I'm asked the same question over and over again? And I don't get excited as much, you know, toward the end of the tour as I am at the beginning of the tour. But it's the responsibility to this conversation. So I don't have a specific reader. I mean, you, all of you are specific readers now. And the more readers there are, and may there be many, the bigger the conversation becomes. The more I have to think about what I'm doing to, you know, to comply with this responsibility.
So, which leads me to, and we're going to open up soon to you all, thinking about the quite, you know, difficult and remarkable essay story that ends the book, which is about your daughter Isabel, and my sincere condolences. I read it in the New Yorker, and it's quite a staggering story. And I focus on your conversation in that story with Ella, your daughter, and the birth of storytelling in her. And I thought we might end by your reading a passage of your conversation with Ella.
Let me just find it.
I've got it marked here if you want. It's right here.
Just tell me.
Can I just say as an aside that when I was reading this essay, it was while I was trying to memorize this Auden poem, which is Musée des Beaux-Arts. Right. So when you had the phrase, the torturer's innocent horse, I was like...
Torturer's horse, innocently scratching.
Yes, there it was.
One day at breakfast, while Ella ate her oatmeal and rambled on about her imaginary brother, Mingus, I recognized in a humbling flash that she was doing exactly what I'd been doing as a writer all these years. In my books, fictional characters allowed me to understand what was hard for me to understand, which so far has been nearly everything. Much like Ella, I'd found myself with an excess of words, the wealth of which far exceeded the pathetic limits of my biography. I'd needed narrative space to extend myself into. I'd needed more lives. I, too, had needed another set of parents and someone other than myself to throw my metaphysical tantrums. I had cooked up those avatars in the soup of my ever-changing self, but they were not me. They did what I wouldn't or couldn't. Listening to Ella furiously and endlessly unfurl the yarns of Dominguez tales, I understood that the need to tell stories is deeply embedded in our minds and inseparably entangled with the mechanisms that generate and absorb language. Narrative imagination, and therefore fiction, is a basic evolutionary tool of survival. We process the world by telling stories and produce human knowledge through our engagement with imagined selves. Whatever knowledge I'd acquired in my middling fiction writing career was of no value inside our aquarium, however. I could not write a story that would help me comprehend what was happening. Isabel's illness overrode any kind of imaginative involvement on my part. All I cared about was the hard reality of Isabel's breaths on my chest, the concreteness of her slipping into slumber as I sang my three lullabies. I did not wish or dare to imagine anything beyond her smiles and laughter, beyond her present torturous but still beautiful life.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Can I just ask how Mingus is? Mingus
is alive.
Mingus is alive?
Mingus is alive and well. He has three siblings, and he operates in many ways.
My daughter has come up with an imaginary language, which is called Silent Mastiff. Silent Mastiff. Mastiff like a dog, where she got that from. And so Mingus knows all the words of Silent Mastiff, and she knows all but one. And I asked her, so what is the word that you don't know? And she said, I don't know. I asked her once, I've never seen Mingus. Mingus, this is the first emanation of Mingus. He was an inflatable alien doll, and then he deflated and then was not material since, hasn't been material. And so I asked her, so how come I never see Mingus? You know, you talk about him, I'd like to meet Mingus. And she laughed at me and said, Tata, she calls me Tata. Mingus is imaginary. And to me, it's so beautiful because for her and for me, I understood yet again. I learned so much from my five-year-old daughter. Real and imaginary is not mutually exclusive. We have learned to segregate real and imaginary. But because of her, largely, I understood that you cannot understand the real without deploying your imaginative instinct. You cannot know what is real unless you imagine it, until you imagine it. And this is why fiction and literature is crucial. This is why, you know, when publishing industry vanishes, there will be still stories. There will still be stories that we'll be telling to each other so that we can imagine our own reality.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Sarah has the microphone, and if you put your hand up, she will bring it around to you.
I had the pleasure of visiting Sarajevo around the time you were born, when it was the beautiful city in Tito's Yugoslavia where there was the Brotherhood of Nations. And if anybody had told me that the three religious groups there someday would be at each other's throats, I would have said that's impossible. I'm reminded of UNESCO's play Rhinoceros. I don't know if you've seen it. All you Balkan people must be familiar with the same cultures, right? But in Rhinoceros, some infectious agent enters the community that the people cannot resist. It must be a metaphor for fascism. And I consider fascism an infectious disease. Do you agree?
Well, it is a kind of disease, but it's also... That is, it becomes infectious and infects people who didn't have agency at the beginning. And then they get caught up in that and do things that they could not have imagined doing before. Because of my professor, I as I said in the essay, I wondered, could I have caught it the moment, you know, that would have belied his love of literature? But then I realized I was making an epistemological mistake in that I assumed human and moral, ethical, moral and psychological continuity. This is a privilege of a stable society so that we can imagine ourselves always being the same, so that I was the same person when I was four as I am now, except I'm bigger now, and also, you know, larger thoughts and whatnot. But we easily subscribe to notions, the notion of ethical and psychological continuity. But if there's a historical rupture, or some sort of, or not even historical, some sort of catastrophe, there's a, there's a rupture. It causes psychological and ethical and moral discontinuity. So that it's, I now understand, it's perfectly possible to have a nice, pleasant neighbor who, at the times of peace and social stability, is as good as can be, and then the war starts, and then the neighbor can turn on you because of fascist infection, partly, but also because of the breakdown of societal limits and the communal goals and any number of those things. And then when the war ends, they can all be nice people again. Hmm. The problem is that what's done cannot be undone, so we have legal responsibilities and also moral responsibilities. It should not depend on the circumstances. And there are also people who manage to maintain moral and psychological continuity through all, you know, catastrophes, and those are the people that we know who they are. So that infection, can start, but you do not have to succumb to that. And the infection is not a natural catastrophe. Someone started it. Someone orchestrated it. They had a specific plan and did it. They did it in a particular way. It's not savagery that came from inside and then just took everyone over. What happened in former Yugoslavia and Bosnia is commonly explained in terms of thousands of years of hatred and things like that. My position is that the violence was directly proportional to the strength of the bonds between the people. Mm. So that you needed extreme violence to break it up. So that you had to pound the city for 3 years until neighbors stopped talking to each other. Mm. Because it was very hard to pull that apart. Rather than just people discovering that they're savages and then they start killing each other arbitrarily. So what you saw in 64 was real. And then it was pounded the way it was pounded. And by the people who knew instinctively and sometimes consciously that they knew what they had to destroy. And they went about to destroy it. They went about destroying it.
Any other question?
Why did you decide to stay in Chicago and not go back after the war was over?
By that time, my family was in Canada. I had a life in Chicago. Someone else was living in our apartment in Sarajevo, and it didn't seem that we would ever be able to get it back. And generally, the situation was bleak. And so I didn't go back.
But you go back now. Your family goes back now, right?
Yeah, my sister returned. My parents and my sister ended up in Canada as refugees in 93. And then my sister went back in 98 and then lived in Sarajevo for a few years. And she's a very strong personality and very stubborn. And so she managed to get her apartment back. And then she lived in it while she was in Sarajevo. And then we still have it. And now we, yeah.
Some of the most remarkable parts of the book are describing the uncanniness of going back, of being in a place that you know so well that is the same and is so irreparably changed. I think those are really remarkable way. Uncanny is such is the only word I can think of.
It's unheimlich.
Unheimlich, yes. There's a question back there.
Hi, thank Hi. You so much. I'm just so impressed that you grew up speaking one language and you're now writing in another language. Can you talk about that?
Well, thank you. I like to impress people. when I found myself in Chicago in the early 90s, I realized I would have to stay for a long time. And this is one of the reasons why I didn't go back, because I invested my energy and made a decision to operate under the assumption that I would stay in the United States for a long time. That required a language to write in, because Bosnian, or it used to be called Serbo-Croat before Bosnian independence, was not available to me, or so I felt, because if language is determined by the experience of the people who speak it, I was away from that experience, as horrible as it was. And indeed, during the war, there were new words that I had to learn that appeared in Bosnian, because new experiences generated new words and new ways of talking. So then I figured that I would acquire the language for writing, and I could speak English well enough to get a job and, communicate with people.
You did make things up about yourself to get the job.
I did. I made up a large number of resumes.
Fiction came in handy.
That's right. But also, there were no witnesses. This was very disturbing to me. That is, I could make up my previous life. This is why I had, and still do, have obsession with spies. And spies have a legend. They have an imaginary life that they acquire and then pretend that that's who they were. And I realized that my life was now a legend because there were no witnesses to it available in Chicago at the time. In any case, I figured that I would have to write in English, and the way I went about it was to read a lot. And I think that to acquire writing language, even in your native language, you do it by reading books, not just by talking to people. You have to expand your vocabulary. You operate on that level of language when you write. Now, I also think or learned in that period that to write in any language, it has to be part of your subconscious mind. Obviously, your native language enters it when you're 2 or 3. But for some reason or another, and it could well be that stress played a large role, the English language entered my subconscious mind in the early 90s. And I know this because I would catch myself remembering in English things that would not have taken place, conversations that would not have taken place in English. I would notice people speak English in my dreams, and in my dream I would find it strange. And the way I understand it now is that my subconscious mind was being flooded by English. Now my subconscious mind is bilingual, so that I can write in both languages. I do write in both languages. I can perform simultaneous or have simultaneous conversations with, you know, in Bosnian and English, talk to my parents and then turn to my wife and without, you know, getting confused.
Next question?
Yeah, actually, Alexander, that was part of my question. I come from your country many years ago, and I'm very impressed with what you accomplished.
Thank you.
Wanted to ask you, do you still publish in Bosnian, or do you translate your books into Bosnian yourself, or somebody does it for you?
Somebody does it for me, for my publisher, rather. Some of the early stories I translated, and they were published in Sarajevo, but they were terrible translations. But fortunately, the publisher went under, and many of those books are still in storage somewhere. It's easier to write in two languages than to translate from one to the other.
In 2 weeks, Franz de Waal is going to be here talking about his book, The Bonobo and the Atheist. And his thesis is that we don't need religion to have morality, that it predates our human evolution, and that we can find goodness and cooperation and kindness in other animals. And I wonder, given your own experiences and your exploration of kind of human identity, would you agree with that thesis?
I would. I think that responsibility to other human beings is a good enough basis for morality, rather than to a pressure from, you know, imaginary creatures in heaven and a fear of punishment and fear of, you know, being in the wrong place for eternal life. I think it's deeply embedded in what could be loosely called humanist tradition. It's all over Chekhov. There's no God. No one was thrown out of Eden because there was never Eden. No one was perfect as a human being. No one is perfect as a human being. No one will ever be perfect. No one is purely evil either. So we, you know, the way Nabokov put it about Chekhov's characters, they can neither carry the burden nor be rid of it, the burden of being human. And to me, that's... I don't think that morality, let alone ethics, belongs to the domain of religion. I don't have to quote any number of examples of immoral religious people. So.
Next question right over here.
My mother's side of my family is Czechoslovakian, and with my typical American lack of knowledge of geography, we used to just see a big red spot over there that was communism. What do you think? Why did the Czechoslovakia separate fairly peaceably, and Yugoslavia had? And I know that's a pretty deep question. And Yugoslavia had went
because
throughout
Czechoslovakia had no standing army. The Russians, the Soviets controlled them. So when they retreated, there were no weapons to shoot with. You know, again, the story about thousands of years of hatred, it's just a lazy, easy explanation of that. Yugoslav army was one of the biggest in Europe, saying fourth or fifth, but there were a lot of weapons. They also Yugoslavia was in a position where it was between East and West, so we could get loans from the West, but also, you know, negotiate with the East. Once the fall went down, all that money was gone, and suddenly you have a large number of men with a lot of weapons and nothing to do. I was working as a journalist in 1990 in Sarajevo, and I remember, maybe 91, but around that time, that there was a discussion of the proposal for the budget for next year of Yugoslavia, and the army demanded 61% of the complete budget. That's even impossible in the United States, and we know how much money is spent on weapons here. They just had weapons and nothing to do, in a sense. And so that Milosevic recruited a large number of people, you know, who were ethnically Serbian. They were more likely to join him. Not everyone joined his project. On the Croatian side, it was the same thing. There was employment. And, you know, war is profitable for those who, for many people, who, as we also know here, it's a profitable venture, except for the people who get killed. So Czechoslovakia, it was peaceful, and the transition in Eastern Europe was largely peaceful because Poland and Czechoslovakia and Bulgaria, they had no weapons. The Soviets took them with them when they retreated. They would have had to do it with sticks.
Vozdrav, Saša, čestitam na uspjehu.
Hvala.
I am from Sarajevo and I was in war, and I have this personal experience also. This is what you are talking about in your book. But I'm a little bit disappointed also because you didn't mention soccer at all.
No,
that's probably because
there is a piece in the book about it.
There is a good piece in the book about it.
I was pleased when you mentioned briefly about the use of the national language, national culture, etc., etc. And I think the case of your professor or all intellectual in Bosnia, this is something what puzzled my mind still today. Those people laid foundation for all this crime and genocide and savages and atrocity. How is that possible that intellectual, first of all, in a small culture like ours was in Yugoslavia, how is possible that all of them serving such evil things?
Well, it wasn't all of them, but I know exactly what you mean. I think it was possible because the concept of national and therefore nationalist culture was the dominant one. And the only alternative was, or the other alternative that was available strong enough was, you know, communism, socialism, which failed. And it was not available. There was when I was between second half of the 80s until the beginning of the war, when I was young, we had a sense that there was a third way of, you know, getting out of the situation. And then there were writers and intellectuals who, to me, seemed to show the way in any number of ways. Danilo Kish, for instance, the great writer who died in 89. There were also political figures who were trying to go beyond nationalist identities or nationalist projects and national identities that didn't work out, but there was a way. The intellectuals, as I said, talking about my professor, unfortunately, the equation which you, if you study Kant or read Shakespeare, that does not turn you into a moral person. That does not prevent you in any way from becoming a fascist. Or in any other art, you know. In 1944 in Berlin, there was this famous performance of Beethoven's Ninth Symphony. All the Nazis were there, and Herbert von Karajan conducted. And then they went on to complete the Final Solution, to try to do that. There was no contradiction at all. So not only that, but to genocide is not savagery. The Holocaust was not savagery. Rwanda was not savagery. What happened in Bosnia was not savagery. On the contrary, you need an advanced infrastructure. You need developed media. You need thinkers. You need ideologues, and you need people who will, you know, convert it all into discourse that could be fed to people who are going to die in the trenches. So not only that the intellectuals can do it, they are necessary for such projects. Without them, it cannot be done. Otherwise, people will be beating each other with sticks. It's, you know, it's hard to complete a genocide with sticks.
I take one last question.
I shouldn't ask, but the premise is Camus says that if you kill one man should be involved. It's one-on-one. And the war in Bosnia, I figure, ended when Clinton, according to the Iran game, bombed the Serbian civil population night after night after night. So is that a justifiable act?
A justifiable act? Well, they were bombing troops, too. It's not something I wish to get into, but you could also argue that it prevented or stopped an ongoing genocide. Albanian population was being thrown out and killed at that time. It was hundreds of thousands of refugees that were trying to leave Kosovo. There was and this is not necessarily the defense of such acts, but the reason it was done largely because Europe could not stand another wave of refugees. And so that had to be stopped. Once you make a decision to intervene at any point, then it becomes kind of a rolling decision-making process. And so that there is certainly a continuity of some sort between making a choice like that and invading Iraq. But I also know that had there been an intervention early in the 90s, at the beginning of the war, 91 or 92, that the outcome of Bosnian war would have been entirely different. Milosevic needed some beating, but the backing off empowered him in more ways than one. And by 95, so many people died, so much was destroyed. So it is not for me, who I'm a civilian, I was not exposed to, that is, I don't have no ability to make any kind of military, tactical, or strategic decision. Also, I was not shot at. It is not for me to say with absolute certainty what's right and what's wrong in those situations. But I also know that that wars can be stopped. Right? One way to stop the war is not to start it. But also, once they start, something needs to be done. I wish something is happening to help this people in Syria, yeah, because so many people are dying. And it's not impossible to help with putting an end to that.
Sasha, I want to thank you for your moral clarity and your imagination and for weathering Los Angeles traffic. And please come see us again.
That was the hardest thing.
Thank you all. And if you enjoyed tonight...
Thank you.
Please consider becoming a Library Foundation member so that we can stay
Aloud
strong.
Is made
Thank
possible
so
through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, Errant Fox, City National Bank, KPMG, Donna and Martin J. Wolf, and the Bujaki Foundation. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Council of the Library Foundation, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and LA Weekly. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.